Essa é a SBS em português.
Hi, Dr. Peter Job. We appreciate you finding the time to chat with us on Timor, the Timorese people, perhaps your personal experience throughout the invasion and occupation period, particularly from 1975 to 1983, when the worst atrocities occurred in East Timor. And finally, to present your recently published book called A Narrative of Denial. It's a great, great pleasure to have you with us today. So we know you were involved in the East Timor support movement during the Indonesian occupation, including working on the radio linked to Fretilin in 1978. How was to be involved in such a crucial and historical moment for Timor?
I was very young at the time. I was 20 years old. I met some Timorese people and I knew that terrible things were happening in East Timor. It was of good to be able to be helpful in that regard. The frustrating thing was the great complacency in Australia about the situation there, partly from the Australian people, but mostly from our governments that was denying that there was a crisis there. I knew very well from the information we were receiving from the radio and from which was coming in from another sources as well, that there was a massive humanitarian catastrophe occurring in East Timor. It was very difficult to get members of the public to believe us because the government was constantly denying that this was the case and covering up the situation in East Timor on behalf of the Suharto regime.
Mm-hmm. And now comparing Timor from those days with today's Timor, how you would describe the differences, the main differences?
Well, Timor, the Timorese people have managed to achieve their own liberation through a 24-year-old struggle supported by many, many people in Timorese society from a very broad range of positions have fought very hard for an independent East Timor. East Timor today is a democracy, and we're having elections today. A number of studies have ranked East Timor, Timor-Leste, as the most democratic country in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And if anyone's been over there and looked at the body politic and the different political parties and the kinds of debates they have, it is indeed a rigorous democracy in which various debates take place, and democratic and in which people can speak their mind, which is not true in many areas of Southeast Asia.
Now let's focus on your book, finally, A Narrative of Denial. First of all, can you please explain us why is your book entitled A Narrative of Denial?
My book is an extensive study of Australian policy during the occupation period, particularly in the years 1975 to 1983, when the very worst of the atrocities were occurring. It's been estimated that during the occupation, up to a third of the population were killed due to the invasion and occupation. Most of that happened in those years, 75 to 83. During that time, the Australian government engaged in a systematic campaign of disinformation on behalf of the Suharto regime to protect it and deny what was happening. It did that in three ways. First of all, it distorted the events leading to the invasion to make it look like it was not the Indonesians' fault. In fact, well before the invasion, embarked on an extensive campaign to destabilize East Timor. And then they used that destabilization they'd caused themselves as a pretext for invasion. So the Australian government protected Indonesia in that way. Secondly, when massive atrocities were occurring in those years, I should say there was a campaign of encirclement and annihilation to destroy food resources in the rural areas to make the Fretilin and their supporters surrender. Australia denied that it was happening and said publicly to the Australian people, but most importantly, at the United Nations and to other nations who are interested in the area, that these events were not happening. There were a number of nations that wished to investigate and were very concerned. Australia did what it could to dampen down their concerns and to assure them that that situation wasn't real. As events progressed, it became increasingly difficult, however, for the Australian government to deny the evidence that was coming out of East Timor of a catastrophe. So, and then it started spinning it in another way. It said that it was not the Indonesians' fault. It denied that there was an encirclement of annihilation, despite the fact that they were very well informed about the real situation. And they blamed it instead on Timorese underdevelopment, which was not accurate. The famine was caused by the destruction of rural food resources resulted in the catastrophe due to the Indonesian campaign. Their intelligence actually knew that, so they embarked on disinformation on behalf of Suharto and his regime.
So during the occupation, Australia continued to provide military aid to the Indonesian military. Is there evidence any of it was used in East Timor?
Indeed, there is. I should say that the aid they provided was quite substantial. It included 18 Nomad aircraft, 16 Sabre aircraft, 12 helicopters, 250 military Land Rovers, 8 patrol boats, field transmitters. Now, when the invasion happened, Australia obtained a verbal agreement, nothing more, that Australian equipment would not be used in East Timor. However, I came across a document which is a description of a visit of an Australian official, an embassy official from the Australian Embassy in Jakarta, to East Timor, and he cited a Nomad aircraft parked on the apron of Comero Airfield in January 1979. That was before Australia had even extended recognition of the Indonesian takeover. That means those aircraft certainly were used in East Timor. This, of course, should have led to some sort of complaint from the Australians, because they did have this agreement. Yet there was nothing. Australia was perfectly willing to accept that Australian aircraft were being used in the campaign of encirclement and annihilation to destroy Fretland and to destroy food resources, which, of course, just didn't target Fretland. It targeted many civilians as well. Nomad aircraft would have been well suited to that kind of surveillance. They weren't attack aircraft. What they did was provide information to allow the military to identify where Fretland, where civilians were, so they could be targeted.
So did the Australian position really matter? Was Australia in a position to influence Indonesia policy or actions or change the course of events in East Timor?
Indeed, there's lots of evidence. And as I said, I've gone through tens of thousands of Department of Foreign Affairs documents that the Indonesians were deeply concerned about Western opinion, and particularly about two countries, the United States and Australia. Initially, the foreign minister, who was Adam Malik, who was foreign minister before the invasion, did not support an intervention. He tried to push policy direction towards accepting an independent East Timor. He believed that an intervention would undermine Indonesian standing in the world, particularly in the non-aligned movement, of which it sought a key role. Australia could have gone either way. It could have supported Malik and encouraged the Indonesians to reach an accommodation with an independent East Timor. Instead, it chose to support the very hardline Opsis faction, and that's a faction of hardliners within the Suharto regime that were determined to incorporate East Timor by any means necessary, including by invasion and through annihilation, and its encirclement and annihilation. So, again and again, in the documentation, you see the concern from Suharto himself, from the foreign minister, and from others about Western opinion. Only when it was clear that the Australians would not object to an Indonesian invasion did they go ahead and intervene. And only when it was clear that Australia would not object to a campaign previous to that of destabilizing the territory, did they go ahead and take that course of action too. So it's clear that had Australia made it clear that they supported a proper decolonization process and made that a priority, that Indonesia would have taken that Australian position very seriously, and it is unlikely that the invasion would have occurred.
You described the book as an account of policy failure. In what ways do you argue Australian policy regarding the occupation of East Timor failed during this period?
Well, it really failed in three ways. First of all, it failed in its own terms. Policy wants in the Department of Foreign Affairs thought that they had to cozy up to the Suharto regime to make themselves popular with it. But it didn't work. The Indonesian invasion, the evidence that came out over the years of atrocities occurring there, led to a great deal of suspicion in the Australian community of the Suharto regime. And that eventually led to the Interfed intervention. So it did not improve relations with Indonesia at all. Eventually, it did quite the opposite. Secondly, it failed in another way. It was a failure of trust. The Australian government, through a variety of government, not only Whitlam, Fraser, and Hawke, Keating, and Howard, at one stage or the other, lied to the Australian people and the international community about the reality of what was happening there. In a democratic nation, that is unacceptable. And thirdly, it was a failure of what I'd call conception and morality, a failure to recognise the legitimacy of Timorese aspirations for independence, a failure to recognise and respond to massive human rights violations. And that's probably the worst way that it failed, in that we did not do our democratic duty. First of all, to support the legitimate aspirations and of the Timorese people, and to condemn the atrocities when they were occurring.
Mm-hmm. And how did the Australian government campaign on the issue in the international arena? What impact did this have?
They campaigned on it in a number of ways. One of them, the main forums in which they did so, was at the United Nations. Now, there were yearly resolutions on East Timor from 1975 until 1982, condemning in one way the invasion. The Australian government very reluctantly supported the first one. After that, it went to abstention, and then it voted against them. But more than that, it campaigned on a country-to-country basis on behalf of the Suharto regime. And as I said, denying the reality of what was happening and attempting to remove the issue from the UN agenda and telling countries that they'd done their own investigations and that the atrocities that were being alleged were not true. This had a significant impact because Australia at that time was seen as something of an expert on East Timor because of its proximity, mm-hmm. and because Australia was believed to be a Western nation that respected international norms. The Dutch, for example, at one stage wanted to instigate an investigation into what was happening in East Timor. They were talked out of it by Australia. The Swedes were concerned by it. Once again, Australia went and lobbied in Sweden and told them that these atrocities were not occurring. Even the military government in Brazil at one stage expressed deep concerns about it. And once again, at the request of the Indonesians, Australian officials went to their foreign ministry and told them that these atrocities were not occurring and that there was no need to be concerned. They did that in a number of other forums. They did it at the Commonwealth, at the International Parliamentary Union, and throughout forums throughout the world.
So what do we know about the true situation in East Timor? How have the positions of the Australian government and its critics stood the test of time?
Well, after independence, the Timorese undertook their own truth and reconciliation program. And that to that end, they hired a number of key experts from the international community, the Benetton Group, that was a New York-based group, and a number of others to produce a very, very extensive report called the Shaga Report. That is an investigation into the human rights and humanitarian situation during the occupation. It's very detailed. It is over 1,000 pages long, and it documents extensive human rights abuses and an extensive loss of life based on an extensive fact-based investigation, with many interviews, surveys of graves, and many other methods that they use to verify that, in fact, these atrocities did take place. There can no longer be any doubt whatsoever. Of course, there shouldn't have been any doubt because the evidence was sufficient even during the invasion. The Australian government was simply denying it. Now there can be no doubt whatsoever that what the Timorese were saying at the time and what the activists who were supporting them were saying at the time was true, that massive violations were occurring and a very high death toll.
So now our final question is about today's election. So today is the presidential election day in Timor. Guterres and Ramos Horta are the candidates in the run. Which one do you think would be a better president for Timor nowadays?
Well, I should explain. I campaigned for an independent East Timor, for the Timorese people to be able to determine their own future. And for that reason, I actually don't think it's my role to tell them which president would be better. I think it's up to them to choose. I should say, however, that they are both admirable individuals who contributed greatly to Timor. I think they both make good presidents, and I'll only wish luck to both of them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Peter.
Curta, compartilhe, comente. Siga a SBS em português no Facebook.